Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Good evening.
You're listening to Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. We thank you for tuning in and hope you enjoy another exciting episode of our show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. It's actually the 28th of June. We've gotten through 6 months real quick, but it's 90 degrees up here in New Jersey. Feels more like 95. We got a heat wave that's been coming through the last couple of days. But getting to the news at hand, we know Derek Chauvin, he got sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the death of George Floyd, but he will remain in a segregation unit at a maximum security prison for the time being, the Minnesota Department of Corrections said on Monday. Now, Chauvin, who's 45 years old, like I said, was sentenced Friday to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of George Floyd. He's been held at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Oak Park Heights, where he is living apart from the general population of the prison in the administrative control unit, since the jury found him guilty in April of murdering George Floyd. Typically, after a sentencing hearing in Minnesota, male inmates are brought to the Minnesota Correctional Facility at St. Cloud, a lower security facility, where they are booked and assessed. Their photos and fingerprints are taken, and they are given an evaluation before being sent to more permanent housing assignments. A DLC spokesperson told Insider Chauvin was already being held at Oak Park Heights before the sentencing hearing, and so would not go through with that intake process. He was at Oak Park Heights for a safety pre-sentencing, the spokesperson said. Since he was already at Oak Park Heights and was going to stay there, it would not have made sense to bring him up to St. Cloud. Now, he's among nearly 300 convicted killers at the prison, but Oak Park Heights is currently housing 341 inmates, just under 40% of whom identify as white, according to the prison's data. Of those prisoners, 276 are serving sentences for homicide. Chauvin was convicted of killing Floyd by kneeling on his neck and back for more than 9 minutes as he begged for his life. His sentence of 22.5 years is higher than the average sentence of 12 and a half years for the average first-time offender charged with the same crime. A judge found that aggravating factors at the time of Floyd's death called for the upward departure from sentencing guidelines. Minnesota inmates must serve the minimum of two-thirds of the sentence, meaning Chauvin could be released in 15 years. Now, it's caused a little bit of controversy, maybe a lot of controversy, because some people will say, you know what, that's not enough. Some people will say maybe he should be released when George Floyd can walk out of a grave. But maybe it's the start of a new day. You know, there was a time where officers would probably serve a suspension, come back to work. Now, this is not it, because individuals have got too lax, too complacent, and too confident that they can get these things off. And the law is showing them, well, you must pay for the crime the same way you were given the power to enforce the law. Now the law will be enacted on you. So good luck, man. Hope you don't get put in general population, because it's going to be a rough day for you. Let's see what those knees can do. Anyway, in other news, man, I found this other article. It says Scottie Pippen says, in fact, let me get back to it because it just clicked off. Maybe it didn't want me to read it, but Scottie Pippen says Phil Jackson drawing up final shot versus Knicks for Tony Kukoc was racially motivated. people are retiring for and all kinds of things are coming out now. It's interesting, you know what I'm saying? But it said Scottie Pippen hadn't been afraid to share thoughts on a variety of topics surrounding the NBA lately. In an extensive interview with GQ, published last week, Pippen characterized former Bulls coach Phil Jackson's decision to give rookie Tony Kukoc the final shot of a playoff game against the New York Knicks in 1994 as racial. The six-time NBA champion famously refused to go back in the game. Pippen was asked to elaborate during an appearance on the Dan Patrick Show on Monday. His response resulted in a further flipping of Jackson and eventually flowed into calling former teammate Michael Jordan selfish. Now, this is what Scottie Pippen said about Phil Jackson. Patrick explicitly referenced the GQ interview, and Pippen reiterated that he felt he was owed the opportunity to try to win the game for the Bulls. Can I get one shot, he rhetorically asked. Patrick kept pressing on the racial point. Have you talked to Phil about this? By saying it was a racial move, then you're calling Phil a racist. Phil responded, I don't got a problem with that. Patrick, do you think Phil was or is? Pippen, oh yeah. I mean, do you remember Phil Jackson went and left the Lakers, wrote a book about Kobe Bryant, and then came back and coached him? Who would do that? You name someone in professional sports who would do that. I think he probably exposed Kobe in a way that he shouldn't have. Patrick responded that, in his opinion, Jackson was disloyal rather than racist. That's your way of putting it out, Pippen said. I have my way. I was in the locker room with him. I was in practices with him. You're looking from afar. Now, here's what Scottie Pippen said about Michael Jordan. Patrick then brought up how Jackson drew up a play in Game 6 of the 1997 Finals for Steve Kerr instead of Michael Jordan. Pippen corrected Patrick to say that the play was for Jordan, who had an exchange with Kerr in the huddle before that play. You know, all of those cameras sitting in the huddle, who they was working for? You know who Michael was speaking to when he said that? That was planned. That was speaking to the camera. Had John Stockton not come down, trust me, Jordan would have shot. That was building on his own documentary because he was controlling the cameras. That was not naturally spoken. That was rehearsed. Man, what you see on the outside is not always what takes place on the inside. It's real interesting to see how things, I guess the light is being turned on. And as the light gets turned on, some things come to light that we really didn't want to see, but they're going to show it to us anyway, because sometimes we need to see these things. Sometimes it's just good information. But you know what? We're about to get into some good information and get into the show. It's the Sixth Man, Dean Geronimo. I'm here in the studio from NJ to NC with my right-hand man, Mark Lee. So, Mark, tell me what's good in your neck of the woods, my brother.
Oh, it's quiet over here in Durham, North Carolina, even though I just stepped outside and there was a little bit of that wet stuff falling down from the sky. You know, that stuff that they call rain. So it was a quick drizzle. It might be on its way out. But, yeah, there was some of that rain drops falling on my head as I was coming from the store. You know, I had went and got a quick little bite to eat since the money was a little funny, so I had to go figure out somewhere that I could grab like a soup or something quick to eat, and I was grabbing something, and as I came back with my soda and soup, I was like, whoa, this is what they call raindrops. Raindrops falling on my head. So I was checking out them raindrops falling on my head, and you know, then I wait for the government cheese or the personal cheese or some sort of cheese to fall down in my pocket shortly. But once that cheese falls, then things will be a little bit better. But while I'm waiting, I had to do that survive and thrive kind of thing that we do as humans when we reach into the pocket and the pocket says, "You think there's something in here? What are you kidding me? You got to be joking me. I didn't put anything in you, so how can there be anything in here?" So, like I said, I did the old scrounge thing and all of that. But, you know, everything is good. We had a few raindrops. Yesterday I went out for a walk and saw some of the rabbits jumping around. So the rabbits were happy. They were like, whoa, this is our kind of weather. So definitely it's been some good weather, even though it's been definitely on the toasty side. It has been, no doubt it has been on the toasty side down here in the Carolinas. But, you know, I understand it's been toasty around the world, because I was watching one of the local news reports and they were showing some weather from around the world, and I think they even said it was like 95 or 100 degrees in the Siberia. You know, that's where it's supposed to be, like, really cold, where they send people in Russia to isolation,
man.
And everything.
Yeah.
But it was, like, 100 degrees in Siberia and, like, a 95 or 98 in Moscow. So I'm going, like, but, you know, certain people, including the person that used to occupy 1600, doesn't not believe that global warming exists. So, you know, I don't get that, but I don't get a lot of things. Because I was watching this guy on and I was talking to a guest on one of my other shows about this, but I was watching this guy, and you might have seen him. And I'm not saying that he doesn't have some good points, but I was watching this YouTube star who apparently is unmarried himself, but he likes to give a lot of advice to single women about what they're doing wrong. I think the guy's name is
Kevin
Samuel,
Samuel
or something like that. And I'm
thinking, yeah.
I was
very
sitting there
interesting.
Watching him. I'm like, some of this advice he's giving, I mean, he was talking to this one single woman that has got a job. Now, she's a single mother. I'll give her that. But he's a single mother, was apparently in a toxic relationship, and has her own catering business, and apparently has some guys courting her. But the way he was saying this, you would have thought she was the worst thing since sliced bread, and she was doing a disservice to women in general, and she was out there hunting for a stepfather and not hunting for a mate or a significant other. But like I said, I don't know why I stumbled across him, but it was like watching a train wreck.
Yeah, he is very unique, bruh. And, I mean, it's one of those things where you watch and you say, you know what, I can't believe this is really happening right now. It's a whole lot of dudes, though, that actually listen to this guy, man. And I'm like, you know what? I don't know. I listened for a couple of minutes, and it got so silly to me, I just went on ahead and said, you know what? Anyone who subjects themselves to that type of abuse, I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, I did start wondering that question as well, because, like I said, you know, I've done live streams, so I know that you can exit just like you can enter. So some of these people that subject themselves to the torture, I'm going, like, I hope that they're getting paid for these appearances, because to go through that kind of torture just for the sake of it doesn't make no sense to me. Because, like I said, I fast-forwarded on one of them, and I think the young lady had been in and there for maybe 40 minutes, and I think I fast-forwarded on another one, and somebody had suggested themselves for like an hour and something. And I'm like, at some point, don't you just like have to have common sense to be like, this guy is not on my side. He's not going to be defending what is going on in my life and everything. So I'm going to bail. But apparently he's got lots of views in YouTube. You know, they say controversy is something that you can use to get your views up and all of that. But, you know, I'm going to just stick to presenting information, presenting positive guests, and giving good information. Now, if they got controversial views and they want to share that with our listeners, that's on them. But I'm not going to sit there trying to bait them, which is what it seemed like he was doing.
Oh, man, he's horrible, man. He is horrible. And I just look and I say, how in the hell do you just take that type of fucking abuse? You know what I mean? Like, how do you take that type of abuse? I don't know. Maybe I'm just dumb. I'm not meant to know this stuff, but I just don't understand it. And I'm like,
yeah, I didn't
damn,
understand
this dude is out of control, man. Like, you know, out of control, like out of control. And it's
no,
like,
I agree, he's out of control. Speaking of out of control, I have been spending some time on the weekend. I'll probably do it after we're done and everything, watching the NBA games. I am expecting Phoenix to close out tonight, but who knows, maybe the Clippers will surprise me. They don't have Kawhi, but maybe just on GP, maybe they'll push a game six, but it is in Phoenix. But this other series is going to be really interesting. Right now, Milwaukee's got the advantage. They're up 2-1 after a sensational game from Chris Middleton and everything, and also the big center in Milwaukee. So definitely he had a great game, but, you know, they're up 2-1, so they've reclaimed home court advantage. If they beat them again in Atlanta, even though Trae Young is amazing and scored a lot of points, we might just have to put it as a wrap with a Phoenix-Milwaukee series. But if they make it 2-2, you know, it's anybody's battle. So if they come back and win the other game at home, which everybody, I think, is expecting them to do, then, you know, Milwaukee does have the advantage because two of their games are at home and one's in Atlanta. But still, it's right. still anybody's battle. But I'm still, right now, I'm thinking it's going to be Phoenix against Milwaukee in the finals. I know that Charles Barkley wants it to be Phoenix winning it all. In that case, I don't think there's a lose situation. Like I said, I went to school in Milwaukee and Marquette, so I wouldn't mind the Bucks winning the championship. They ain't won one since Lou Alcindor was over there, because I think he was the Lou Alcindor at that time and everything. So it's been a minute since they've won a championship. So I wouldn't mind seeing them win. But, you know, it's been a minute for Phoenix as well. And, you know, Chris Paul is apparently one. You're talking about what you were saying earlier about Michael and Scotty. Everything I'm hearing, and I don't know this as an individual personally, but I know he did some amazing things with North Carolina A&T, and he's done some amazing things with some other HBCUs. So right. he seems to be one of those heroes that doesn't have a ring. I know Charles never got his ring either, but, you know, it'd be good to see some of these heroes that don't have a ring getting a ring. So if, you know, if Chris Paul got one for Phoenix, I would not be mad about that either.
It's, you know, like I said, I just read the little news articles and stuff. Like, it's the last official basketball game that I checked out, man, it was maybe in the mid-90s. So I'm far removed. Well, back then Charles Barkley was playing, you know, but he's not playing anymore, of course. But, you know, I've seen maybe about one game since then. And that's when I decided to just focus on that. You know, that one sport. I'm still waiting. Hey, man, it's about to be July, Jack. So August is coming. September will be here soon. You know.
Yeah, and the football season is around the corner. There ain't no doubt about that, you know.
Yes, sir.
I was just thinking about that recently. I was just thinking that I need to get in touch with my buddy Randy and definitely, you know, always in touch on some level or another with my younger brother, but I need to get in touch with the crew and find out whether we're going to have a live in-person draft or we're going to do it virtually and when it's going to be coming around. Because, you know, that fantasy draft is just around the corner. We're talking about just a matter of about a month or so before it'd be time for us to pick our players and our defenses and all of that. So definitely I'm with you on the football around the corner. Speaking of things around the corner, I was in a room, I think it might have been one of the clubhouse rooms, and they were talking music and they were talking, you know, entertainment, and they were talking other kind of things. And somehow a performer came up that you are quite familiar with, but they did not know until I had to, you know, school them, because sometimes it's fun to school people as well, that this person has North Carolina roots. But they were talking about rappers that they had a great deal of admiration for, so they were definitely singing the praises, and I would agree that she deserves the praises of MC Light. I would have added the conversation. I would have added Queen Latifah, but they were, you know, singing the praises of MC Light. But, you know, in the course of the conversation, they mentioned that they loved this lovely performer by the name of Rhapsody. And, you know, I had to let them know that Rhapsody was a homegrown talent and all of that.
Snow Hill, North Carolina, stand up, y'all.
They did not know that. And I think they were, like, from the Midwest or maybe the West Coast. But when I broke it down that they were a North Carolina talent, they were like, oh, wow. But they really were big-time fans of Rhapsody, like what Rhapsody is all about. So I had to give you a shout-out. So, you know, sometimes even though I'm in the same state, well, I'm not always talking to them, but you might even talk tonight before I do. So you just have to let them know that Rhapsody got some love in one of the clubhouse rooms, and that, you know, Mr. Lee did defend the reason for that love was well-deserved, and they need to continue with that love. So you can let a nice note that I was letting them know that the love was deserved, that she was part of the crew and all of that. So definitely letting them know that she's got that talent from right here. And, of course, Ninth is right here as well. Of course, he'll be up in your neck of the woods because he goes back and forth between teaching up there in the New York areas and then teaching down here between Duke and Central. He just loves both between New York and North Carolina.
Hey, man, you know what? For those folks that are actually blessed to have him as a professor, y'all, you know what? That's awesome. It is. It's awesome. That's all I can say. It's awesome, man.
Yeah. Speaking of awesome, yes, I saw this interesting article here in North Carolina. You know, I was just stumbling through my news and everything, and this just came across my news feed. Apparently, it came down earlier today. But there's a restaurant here in Durham that has got a unique idea. They have added, you know, they want to pay their employees a fair wage. So one of the ways that they've done is they are adding a gratuity meal. So apparently a restaurant in Durham that is now paying employees a fair wage, but that means some customers could be left with a bigger bill. So this restaurant, that's a pizza restaurant, Pizzeria Toro, Pizza Bull, added a 20% gratuity to every bill for dining customers, along with a message saying, seen and unseen hourly wage workers are the backbone of the restaurant. So Gray Brooks is the chef and one of the owners, and he said prep cooks and dishwashers had to work two jobs. He sees the fee as a way to close the wage gap between staff who traditionally did not make tips and those who did. So, you know, he's definitely looking out for his folks that are behind the scenes and everything. But it looks like he's added this 20% gratuity onto everybody's bill if you're dining in.
Wow. Well, it depends on where you go. You know, part of the eight already get it added to their bill. So, hey, it can happen. You know what I mean? It can happen.
Yes, it can happen. It's going to be interesting. Going to be interesting to see. I was just reading what our living wage is, but they were saying that according to the MIT Living Wage Calculator, the living wage for a single adult in Durham County is $16 an hour, more than double the current minimum wage. So apparently we're doing well in terms of how we're doing with living wages and all of that. But that's because we've got some restaurants like this and others that are trying to do positive things in order to help folks out and all of that. But, you know, I was hearing a conversation earlier today about the infrastructure, and they're talking about how part of the infrastructure bill that I think Biden is trying to get through deals with what people consider traditional infrastructure, road buildings, things of that nature. But, you know, he's also trying to add some human infrastructure, and I have no problem with that. They're going to add, like, some better wages, and they're going to add some other things in there, but some other people aren't necessarily doing that. So what are your thoughts on the infrastructure bill, and are we going to get a real infrastructure bill passed? And better yet, is there going to be a fourth stimulus? Because, you know, I've heard speculation about this fourth stimulus, and then I've other heard people saying, no, stimuluses are done. You will not see another one of those for another 100 years.
You know what? At this point, man, I think they need to do something different other than handing you a couple of dollars and a couple of dollars here and a couple of dollars there. They need to go and reverse that tax structure that took place when Dump was in office. They need to actually do some things like raising the minimum wage, like stop giving us the money in pieces and raise that minimum wage for those individuals who are actually working. The people who are not working, if they're able-bodied and they're not working and it's by choice, they shouldn't get anything. And that's just the way that I feel. There are individuals who are out here actually working, but they have to work two and maybe three jobs because the base pay is still at $7 and some change. Like, everything has gone up except the federal minimum wage. I'm not worried about those individuals who decide to sit at home. No, there should not be any welfare for them either. We grew up and we learned closed mouths don't get fed. The people that are actively trying to do something and to better themselves, now those that are disabled, yeah, they do need to get assistance, because were they not disabled, they more than likely would probably be doing, you know, productive work. But I'm talking about those lazy bums that have been sitting around for years waiting for the first of the month because welfare check comes. Nothing's wrong with them. They just refuse to work because as long as our simple-ass government, and I'll say it just like that, continues to give them the few dollars that they give them, but if you multiply that by thousands of people, and I don't care what race you are, anything like that, you're just living and you're just existing, and you need to exist in the worst possible conditions that you can, because you won't get up and do anything better for yourself. This is going to sound harsh. This is my opinion. It's not your opinion. It's not the opinion of the show. But if you have children and you bring them into that type of life, then all of y'all should suffer. I don't feel bad for the kids either, because the parents suck. But we'll take your kids from you and give them to someone who will take care of them and allow you to suffer by yourself. You know, but when you talk about that infrastructure bill, it sounds nice, but you know what, man? I don't see where it's going to go. Like, it says it's going to create jobs. It's saying it's going to lower energy bills. Prove it to me. We've heard a lot of talk over a lot of years about things that could be so great. And then in practice, it's horrible. So maybe, I wouldn't say not do it. I want to see what happens if it's done. But there should be a caveat there that if it doesn't work, then we got to scrap this and go somewhere else. Because we get on that
we
one track.
Try another tactic. Is that what you're trying to say? We're going to have to
we
got to
try something different, man. Like, that same way is not working. It is not working. You know, talking somebody to death about what you can do for them and then walking away and not doing anything at all is worthless. It's time to do something different. And I don't care about what political party you belong to. To hell with your lies. To hell with your promises. Whoever has the better ideas and is willing to enforce them is the one who deserves the vote. Not for some, because they belong to a machine or they're in with the in crowd. The political thing I really don't do. I can't stand it because it's like it's a popularity contest. And we learned about that way back in like elementary school when, you know, people were running for office who liked who the best, not who was more capable of doing the job. So maybe one day we'll get it right. But you know what? Hey, man, we got somebody at the door that's been kind of standing by for a minute. Want to bring them
all
in
right, well,
and find out who it is.
Let's bring in our guests and everything.
Thank you for calling Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. You are now on the line. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from. Hello? Caller, phone number ending in 9519. You are on the air. Tell us who y'all, where you calling from.
Oh, hey, y'all. This is John Noltner with A Piece of My Mind.
Hey,
how you
doing?
How you guys doing?
All right.
Good. We're just sitting there kicking it about what's going on in the world. You know, Dean, we're sharing a little bit about things going on in the past history of NBA, and we were also talking about a number of other things, even on the political landscape and all of that. So I know that you are definitely involved in that peace activist space, and if you'll tell our listeners here about this current project and how you're doing and the travel and all of that, and maybe even give a definition. I was thinking about this after we had talked earlier today as to what, in your mind, a peace activist is, because, you know, we hear people talking about different kinds of activism, and sometimes people are like, everybody wants peace. There should not even be a need for a peace activist, because nobody really wants to be in war. That means death and destruction. So apparently we all should be peace activists, but what, in your mind, is a peace activist?
I mean, that's the interesting thing, right? Everybody says that they want peace in the world, but we don't always connect our mission and vision and values into how we live our day-to-day lives. And so we might want something, but are we going to do the work to make it happen? So for me, I mean, peace is a collective thing. It does me no good if I'm doing all right myself, but the people around me are not. It does me no good if I'm able to thrive, but everyone around me is not. And so for me, peace is a collective action. It's making sure that everybody in the community has the resources that they need in order to thrive and succeed, in order to pursue, life and the pursuit of happiness. And so, for me, this project I've got called A Piece of My Mind is about listening to people's stories, about hearing the ways people engage with their communities and about ways people look for solutions to some of our most challenging projects or problems. And so what that looks like is simply traveling around the country now. My wife Karen and I sold our house in October. Even though this is a project I've been working on for 12 years, we sort of upped the game a little bit in October, and we sold our house, we bought an RV, and we're currently traveling the country, sitting down, having interviews with people, doing portraits of people, and really taking the opportunity to listen deeply and hear what's on people's hearts and how they are working in their life for the common good. You know, so that's the methodology. Once COVID slows down, we'll be back to our public programming. We used to do a lot of things pre-pandemic at colleges and conferences and community centers, using these stories to encourage conversations and to bridge divides and build community. We've been doing that online through the pandemic, but we're looking forward to fall when things are going to pick up again and we'll be back face-to-face with people as we travel the country.
Now, some of the things that you would think there would hardly be any argument against them, but I'm surprised that there are arguments against them. Like, to me, it seems to me that if we haven't had, and we were talking about this before you joined, John, if we haven't had a wage increase in 20 or 25 or 30 or however many years it's been, that it should almost be naturally logical that we would want a wage increase so that folks can have a better course of living and all of that, and definitely have a more peaceful means of living, because, you know, you can definitely afford things if you're making a livable wage. So what is your thoughts and what are you hearing from the country about this whole concept of livable wages? It seems to me like this one of them conversations that should almost be a non-starter. I mean, it seems to me that we should all want better wages and better income for all of our people and not be stuck, as Dean was just talking, on seven, whatever it is that it's been stuck on for decades.
Yeah. I mean, I think these are where the conversations get difficult, because it seems like it would not be rocket science to say, let's pay people a living wage. But what you find pushing back against that almost immediately is people who are saying, well, that's going to raise the cost of everything. It's going to cost more if you go to McDonald's to get a cheeseburger. And they talk about raising the cost for consumers. What we never really entertain in that conversation is the possibility at all that maybe some of the people at the top who are making enormous salaries maybe could make a little bit less. You know, I think we always enter these conversations saying, oh, if we pay the workers more, it's going to cost the consumer more. We need to look at the fundamental structure of our capitalistic society and understand, you know, whatever the percentage is that a CEO makes over the lowest paid employee in their company, is that just? Is that? You know, a sustainable structure? Is maximum return for investors, is that the only way to measure success? And so I think we could argue all day about where exactly that number should land for wages. And yes, I think more is probably the answer. But I think we also need to consider the fundamental structure about how we do life. And sometimes I think those things get lost in the noise of the debate sometimes. And I think we need to take a couple of steps back and really look at the underlying systems and whether they are systems that we agree with and whether they should continue the way that they are.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense and everything. Definitely, I can see that. What have been some of the interesting stories that you found right now in the West Coast where you are that have really resonated with you and that you've really found interested in that you might want to share with me, Dean, and the other listeners as well?
Yeah, you know, right now we're in Los Angeles, and really what I wanted to focus on here was housing security, was new solutions to homelessness. You know, as I understand it, in L.A., you know, for a long time they were just dismantling and quote-unquote cleaning up these homeless encampments, and I think the last time they did a survey, it was pre-COVID. They did a census to figure out how many homeless people were in the city and or in the county, and they found it to be around 65,000. Some of the folks I'm talking to who are engaged in the issues think it's maybe around 80,000. It's a little bit higher than what's reported. And of course everybody is worried about having these encampments in their backyard, and they wonder what can be done. And so there were enforcement issues, and they were dismantling these camps, but not necessarily providing an alternative for the people who were in them. And so, you know, essentially these camps would just shift over to a new place and crop without addressing any of the underlying problems. So there are some innovative solutions. One thing that has been tried in different communities through COVID is that they could take people out of tent camps and they could move them into some of the hotel rooms, which were not at full occupancy during the pandemic. Well, what they found out in doing that is that these individuals in the process really lost the only community that they had. You know, they lost the connections with the friends and the relationships that they had on the street and in these tent camps. And so maybe that's not the right solution. So in some communities, they're establishing sanctioned tent camps where there's security, there's services, there's bathrooms, and there's access to water and power for charging things. And you know, this seems to be able to allow people to stay together in community and have the support that they're used to while having a little bit more security as well. One of the places I visited was called Hope in the Valley. And, you know, because of some rezoning laws that happened, because of some changes in limits on how many people could be housed in one area, they were able to put up these small temporary shelters. You know, they don't look like a house like you and I might live in, but they are secure, and they have a locking door, and they have heat and cooling, and they attach that service to a caseworker who can help people navigate whatever it is that they're navigating, you know, with the hope of finding some people some stability and some resources so that they can move on and find more permanent housing, secure employment, get job skills, finish an education, whatever the needs might be, whatever the barriers are to housing, they can be addressed and they can move them into a more permanent solution. And those are the kinds of programs that I think give me a little bit of hope that really address the issues in a fact-based manner and are proving some results at a pretty cost-effective way of doing things.
Yeah, it looks like we're seeing more and more of these tent cities you're talking about. I know that even here in Durham, we had an incident last year before the pandemic where there were folks who were creating these tent cities, and they might still even be around and everything. A lot of people were moved into, as you just said, the kind of the hotels and some of the empty buildings prior to the pandemic having that kind of its waning days, as we hope it's having now, even though there are new variants out there that could push this thing even longer and everything along those lines. But I know even here in Durham, there was tent cities that folks were finding in near downtown areas. And I was actually just seeing that earlier this year, hundreds were forced to vacate a tent city just north of uptown Charlotte. And definitely the county was citing these encampments as a public health concern, particularly after they had seen all kinds of things from rat infestations to other kinds of things. But one of the things that Charlotte did, instead of turning a blind eye, the county stepped in and helped. And apparently they partnered with lots of local agencies and nonprofit organizations to offer these residents a free 90-day hotel stay, complete with meals and laundry service and counseling to help with those that might have substance abuse or mental illness. So I was just wondering, are you seeing those kind of efforts take place around the nation when you've been traveling? Because like I said, that definitely got a lot of good play last week in the, one of our state papers down there in the Charlotte area and everything. But I was just wondering, is that something that you're seeing more and more happen in that space of what's going on with our homeless and the tent cities that are existing throughout the country?
Yeah, I mean, I really think more and more, and again, I'm not an expert in housing security. We're just starting to really interview some people who are engaged with it here in Los Angeles. But what I'm seeing more and more is people who are understanding that the solution needs to be holistic. You know, that you can't just criminalize homelessness. You can't just move people off the streets without also offering an infrastructure to give them a path to success. You know, to look at the barriers that are making housing difficult, to actually provide resources and caseworkers who can work people towards getting the documents that they need in order to get employment, getting the training that they need in order to get employment, getting the mental health care that they need to address any issues that might be underlying, you know, and really give people a roadmap to finding a more permanent solution. I think what I hope is that we're finding more of these examples where it is a holistic approach, where it is helping to assess skills and find people, you know, the ability to step up in their lives. And using those models as our sort of beacon of hope, you know, and replicate that across the country. I think that there are a lot of really interesting experiments going on. There's a lot of learning going on. It's a little slow to the table, and it's a little slow to develop. But I think people are doing some remarkable work. And what I hope to do with the Peace of My Mind is to amplify some of those stories of success and use those as our model for how to move forward.
Now, that makes a lot of sense. Now, one thing I was curious about, now, were you the child that was always in that activist figure and was the one that even as a youngster was always doing activism and always trying to, like, you know, do the best common good kind of approach? Or were you the child that went into more of the corporate world and other kinds of world and came into this later in life? So what was kind of the John trajectory into getting into peace activism, I guess is what I'm really asking.
I wish that I would have been one of those people that worked in the corporate world and made $1 million and then decided to find purpose in my life and do something else. But I forgot that part about making $1 million. You know, my dad was a social worker and my mom was an educator, and so that was a modest middle class upbringing. I got my degree in journalism in writing because I wanted to try to understand as many different kinds of people as I could. Earned most of my career, in my 20s and 30s as a freelance photographer, shooting for national magazines and Fortune 500 companies. Always with an eye towards the common good, always with an eye towards seeing the wisdom and beauty in all of the people around me. But it was really about a dozen years ago that I started working on this project, A Piece of My Mind, and became more intentional about using stories to connect people, about using stories to sort of illuminate some universal truths and to deeply listen to people to try to understand some complexities of the human experience, whether that's, you know, across race, ethnicity, gender identity, faith, whatever, you know, class, whatever these real or perceived divisions are in the world, to really take time to hear people's stories, to try to connect across difference like that.
You know, John, you brought it up in a couple of our past interviews, this whole concept of common good and everything. How prevalent do you think it is for folks to be really concerned about the common good? I know that I hope that it's common, but I was just wondering your perception as to how common do you think it is for people to be concerned about the common good? And if I can ask a secondary question, are there any, like, folks that are out there that you have, even in your own mindset, maybe lost hope with? Maybe you feel that they cannot be redeemable, or are all people redeemable? Can we redeem Donald Trump?
I'm not going to speculate on that last question, but I think all people are redeemable. People have to want to be redeemed. I think that there's good in everybody. I think that when we go through this business of vilifying folks and creating boogeymen in the world, we miss the complexity of it. I mean, the truth is that we're all some mix of good and bad. I happen to think that Donald Trump was a horrible president. I happen to think that I disagree with his policy and so on. I don't know on an individual basis whose souls can be redeemed and whose can't, but I want to believe that there's humanity in everybody, and I want to believe in the benefit of the doubt, and I want to take the time to see that humanity. I mean, I think if I had a chance to sit down and interview Donald Trump, probably say yes. I don't know if I would get an authentic conversation or if I would get a canned, a planned response, but I think I could say that about, you know, most anybody in celebrity culture, whether that's politics or sports or the entertainment industry. I think sometimes those celebrity voices are calculated for other purposes other than just being honest and forthright and making a vulnerable connection with people. And at the end of the day, that's what I look to do with these interviews is to have an honest conversation, to explore the things that we know and we don't know, to ask questions about difficult things. And, you know, I think you asked the question of, you know, is everybody interested in the common good? I think that at some level there are common human qualities of empathy and care and support for one another that exist. But whether they rise to the surface or whether they get drowned out in our day-to-day business is a different question.
Are you sometimes surprised? You mentioned the celebrity voice. Are you sometimes surprised when things that we maybe were not expecting come out after the fact? I know that before I came on, Dean was sharing the story of Scottie Pippen and some of Scottie Pippen's views of his past coach and his past coach possibly even having some racist inclinations and things along those lines. And I don't know that Scottie would have said that during his playing days. So just as one that has done these kind of interviews, are you sometimes surprised when people are so forthright after they are out of the quote-unquote limelight?
No, I guess I'm not surprised. You know, this is not an exact parallel, but when I was just down along the border and I was talking to people about immigration issues, you know, we talked to activists and asylum seekers and border patrol agents, and I had a really hard time finding a border patrol agent who would talk to me, you know, because he has supervisors and he's got bosses that are going to, you know, want him to say a particular thing. So I wound up talking to a border patrol agent who was retired, you know, because then he's free from some of the institutional expectations of how he's going to talk. So I suppose you could say the same thing about a retired athlete. You know, when they're in the game, when they're in the mix, you know, they might be reluctant to speak their full truth, more interested in sharing a story that's going to be on brand, that's going to fit their perceived role in the world. But maybe when they retire, they're not feeling beholden to those same standards or those same expectations, and so they can talk a little bit freer. So no, that doesn't surprise me. It also doesn't surprise me that you know, the story that we hear in the media in any given situation is not the full story. You know, we get the soundbite version. We get the narrative that fits the news cycle, and it doesn't surprise me at all to think that if we look a little bit closer, if we understand a little bit deeper, that the full truth is something a little bit more complex than what it is we thought we understood.
Now, one of the things I've heard, and I was wondering your perception of this about the media, is I've heard some people that would argue that the media right now is not truly reflective of the population, that most of us are somewhere in the middle. Like, you might have people that are progressive to middle, and you might have some that are conservative to middle, but they're pretty much in the middle, most of the population, whereas most of the media seems to go to one extreme or the other, according to some folks. But I was just wondering your thoughts on that, because I've heard this argument even in, like, some clubhouse rooms and some other kind of rooms, that the media has gone too far to the extreme and is not truly objective journalism. But I also have some questions as to whether objective journalism is even something that we can live up to and have in a true society, because I think we all bring some bias into what we do in life and everything along those lines. So as one that has done photojournalism, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that the media has gone too far to the extremes, and do you think that objectivity is something that we can have, whether that's in photojournalism or in print journalism?
Yeah, so on the question of the extremes first, I think that you can find media sources who are extreme right. You can find media sources who are extreme left, and those positions can be really profitable. You know, they play on people's desires to scapegoat, and they play on people's sense of confirmation bias, telling people that the other folks are wrong and you're right. And there are echo chambers like that exist in the media ecosystem. That being said, there's also amazing journalism that happens. I've got great friends that are remarkable journalists that are exploring stories in depth and with complexity and with nuanced understanding of really difficult issues around the world. And that media exists out in the world. I think when we point our fingers at media, it's as part of the problem. It's the wrong attack. I think that these media outlets that are more extreme only make an impact because people are feeding them or people are listening to them. And that feeds this perception of polarization. I really think there's good journalism out there. The question is, are we choosing to consume it? Are we choosing to consume the complex, nuanced, well-researched journalism? Or are we choosing to tune in to the stuff that's polarized and spouting rhetoric at us? And I think a lot of us would be disappointed with the way we might answer that. You know, there's something really intoxicating about tuning into those angry talk shows that talk about how wrong the other people are and how right you are. But is that really doing us a service, or can we better inform ourselves by looking at some of that more informed and reasoned journalism, which exists, but we're not consuming? What's the other question? Can things be truly objective? No, I think things can, things will always reflect some sort of a bias. Bias just exists in the world. It just does. And the question is, do we just blindly accept it, or do we challenge it? And do we examine it, and do we find ways to set it aside? I think it's fine if a news story comes from a particular angle. I'd like to be informed about what it is, and I'd like it to be reasonable in its balance.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. I know before when we talked, you were sharing with me some of the things that you found really interesting when you went down to Charleston, and I'd love for you to share maybe even with Dean a little bit about that story as well, because I really did resonate with me when those folks basically shared with some of the facts that what they had gone through has not just been the Dylann Roof incident, but that there had been some history, and also the attitude that you told me that the minister had just about accepting people that might not be agreeable in terms of having the same viewpoints, even within their congregation. So I remember we had that conversation, so this is a different audience, so I'd love for you to share that story as well.
Yeah, sure. And you're talking about when I went to Mother Emanuel Church in right. in Charleston, and I met with Lee Bennett and interviewed him. He's one of the church historians, and was talking about that incident in 2015 where Dylann Roof, white supremacist, walked in and shot and killed 9 members of the congregation after sitting in a Bible study with them for an hour. Here I am, a middle-aged white guy, right? And I'm walking into this church deeply aware of the fact that they trusted this other white man to walk in, and now here I am, a white man who, looks somewhat like the guy who visited this tragedy on them, sitting with a man who looks like the black members of the congregation. And I said to him after a while, I said, Lee, how is it that you, as a congregation, learned to trust again after that trust was violated in such a horrible way? And he looked at me and he said, well, this is not our house. He goes, this is God's house, and we don't get to choose who walks in the door. We are here to love and to serve and to, to build community. And that's what we're going to continue to do. We can't let the evil acts of one man change who we are. And I thought that was pretty remarkable. It was humbling for me to sit there and hear that. And, Lee went on to talk about some of the history of that church. And, 2015 was the first time that I had become aware of Mother Emanuel Church. But that church has a history of a couple hundred years down in Charleston. And there was a day, I think it was the 1830s. Oof, I'm bad at dates, so forgive me if I'm wrong, but it was around the 1830s when a man named Denmark Vesey was a slave. He bought his own freedom, he won Charleston's version of the lottery back in the day. He was able to purchase his own freedom, but he couldn't purchase the freedom of his wife and children, so he stayed in town so that he could see them. He, of course, was really frustrated with the situation, and he started building a group of people to resist, to come up with the slave, to revolt the issue of slavery. Well, that was found out. It was leaked, and a white mob descended on the church, which was the precursor of Mother Emanuel, and burned it to the ground. And more than a couple dozen people from that church, including Denmark Vesey, were hanged in retaliation, which eventually led to South Carolina banning the gathering of black people in church congregations for like 30 years until emancipation. Later on after the Civil War. And so, you know, to understand the complexity of that history, to understand that, Dylann Roof was not just a blip on the radar, but was a long continuation of a history of racial struggle in a community like that, is to give it context and to help illuminate sort of the larger, social struggles that we're dealing with in our country around race. You asked me a lot of questions. Did that answer them, or are there more questions I forgot to answer?
No, that answered the questions. Definitely, you covered it and everything along those lines. So, try to get a feeling for the guests and all of that. One of the things I was going to ask just about who do you consider some of the heroes of the peace activism movement? I know that a lot of people may think about Greta out of climate change, and of course Martin Luther King, and of course Gandhi, but in your mind, are those the only heroes out of the peace activist movement, and who are some of the other ones that you wish more people would know about?
Yeah, I mean, we got Malala in dealing with, women's rights. We've got Mother Teresa, who was taking care of the poor. It's an endless list of people who have won the Nobel Peace Prize. But and these are, of course, some of my heroes. Ila Gandhi is the granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi, and she wrote the foreword for my first book, and I had a chance to spend a few days with her, and I sat down and interviewed Ila Gandhi, and I asked her, what do you wish people knew about your grandfather, or what did they misunderstand about your grandfather? And she said people thought that he was born a great leader, but in fact he wasn't. He had to grow into that role, and he had years of work in South Africa working against racial discrimination in that country, where he was trained as a lawyer, before he ever went on to do the nonviolence work in India that we all know him so well for. And so I think it's really important to me that these heroes are not placed on a pedestal. When we place them on a pedestal, we give them, I think, more power over ourselves than we need to. And I think it's really important to realize that we can all make an impact. I think sometimes we defer our power to celebrities or sports figures or these heroes and wait for them to make a difference, when in fact, if we all got together and we did the little bit of good that we could right where we are, that's the real power of the world.
No, I definitely agree with you on that and everything. And a lot of times we also are shocked when we sometimes find the warts within our heroes, because definitely the heroes had great assets, but they also had warts, and definitely, there is no perfect individual. Maybe some of the ones from back in the biblical day, if you want to have that kind of spiritual belief, but in modern times, I can't think of a perfect individual. So therefore, we can expect them to have warts, and of course, these warts later come out in books after the fact, whether that's the warts around Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or some other things that might have had things that were not all that great about their lifestyle and all of that while they were doing positive change. So just as a peace activist, how do you deal with that when you find out that people may not have been the sunny disposition that you expect them to be as you learn more about them and as you even do some of the research with modern activists?
Yeah. I mean, that's the truth with all of us, right? We all come with the good and the bad, and we all come as a whole package. And you can't discard an entire person because of one aspect that you disagree with. So, yeah, you look at, you know, stories of Dr. King and his infidelity. You look at stories of Gandhi and some of the prejudices that he held, even as he was working, you know, against prejudice. You know, it does not discount the good work that they've done in the world. Of course, we don't condone those other things, but I think we do ourselves a disservice when we discard the entire person because we discover their warts. You know, I would hate for myself to be examined too carefully. You know, I suspect if you and I sat down, we could, you know, we could find some issues in your life and issues in my life. And we all have some of that baggage. If we only measure ourselves by the baggage, if we only measure ourselves with, I'm afraid we're going to be left with a really small crowd of worthy people on the earth.
No, I definitely agree with you that we all have baggage. And sometimes, you know, even in friendship relationships, just like in romantic relationships, you sometimes have to leave that baggage at the door and not get caught up in the baggage. Cause like you said, everybody's got it and you just don't want it to hinder whatever positive works you're doing in life and all of that. What has it been like doing this kind of work and traveling with your partner in crime being part of the team as well? Because you're not just doing this in a silo. You're traveling around with your wife and everything. And I know that my partner in crime on this particular show, Dean, he loves to talk about his partner, which is his wife. And they just actually, the reason we didn't do our show last week is they were celebrating their anniversary and everything. And it was one of those milestone anniversaries. And as I said before, I was not going to get in the way or have Dr. Diamond knock on my door trying to beat me up and everything because I took Dean away for everything because of the show and all of that. So I was not going to have that happen. So I deferred and we opted not to have a show last week and everything. But I was just wondering, what is it like working with your wife and how do you bring her into the whole business of what you're doing and things along those lines? And, you know, maybe Dean has got some advice for you because y'all are part of that marriage business partnership kind of thing. Or maybe you've got some advice for Dean or vice versa.
Well, first off, I want to say, Dean, good call on deciding to be present for that celebration. That was probably a step in the right direction to furthering that relationship, I imagine.
Yes, definitely.
So it's, you know, I had been traveling a lot for a piece of my mind. You know, like I said, I've been working on this project for 12 years, and there have been stretches where I've been gone a lot. You know, in 2019, I think I was away from home 180 days, and that Karen and I decided that wasn't why we got married. You know, we got married because we like each other, and we still do, and we wanted to spend time together. So given the world that we live in, and because I forgot to make that $1 million before I set out on this project, we could not afford to have a house payment and to have Karen quit her job and to pay for our own health insurance. And so we decided we could do two out of the three things, but we couldn't do all three things. So Karen quit her job so that she could come on the road and we could be together more. We decided to pay for our own health insurance and we got rid of the house payment. So that's when we sold the house and we bought this trailer. And it's been 9 months, and so we're living day in and day out together in 280 square feet of the trailer. You know, so we went from not seeing each other enough to maybe every once in a while seeing each other a little bit too much. But at the end of the day, we still like each other. We enjoy traveling together. You know, Karen does her own thing, and so she's not coming out on all of the interviews, but we do a lot of the things together on the road. So when we were down along the border, you know, we were down there in January when Biden came into office and stopped construction of the wall down along the border. So we were down in Nogales, Arizona, and we were able to locate the end of construction. And so Karen came out with me, and we drove out to this spot right where construction had stopped 30 miles east of, well, I don't know if it was 30 miles, but it was east of Nogales, where it went from a 30-foot-high metal wall with barbed wire on top to just four single strands of barbed wire as, you know, marking the border. And, you know, those are some profound moments. We were standing out there all by ourselves, And those are some really profound experiences, as well as meeting some of the asylum seekers and going out into the desert with crosses where migrants have died on their journey. And Karen is present for a lot of those things. And I think that's really important because I feel like if one, because it's important things to see in the world, but two, I feel like if one member of the couple was seeing those things on a regular basis and the other one wasn't, you know, there could be a little disconnect there. And so having that common experience and being able to meet these people and, you know, we, like I say, she's not along with me on every interview, but she also meets a lot of these people and we see a lot of the same things. And so there's a common experience that I think is really important for the longevity of a relationship.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Hey, Dean, what do you think? Do you think you could survive with Dr. Diamond in a RV traveling around the world and all of that? Or would y'all be at each other's throats if y'all were in that confined of a space?
Oh, no, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. We'll be
just like
too busy.
That. Just as simple as that.
Yeah,
we'll be fine.
We'll be too busy venturing out to different places and looking at different spaces, man. And, you know, we don't. 20 years we've been together, I probably can count on one hand the disagreements and arguments we had. So, we don't have to deal with that part of a relationship. Knock on wood, you know, not even knock on wood. That took practice and it took patience on both of our ends. So we'll be fine.
It sounds like
Now, I don't want to paint too rosy of a picture. You know, there are times when Karen tells me to go out for a long walk. You know, it's a small space to live in, but like life, I think the important thing is the commitment to keep showing up, you know, and I think there's a lot to learn from that. We can't expect to sail, you know, I'm not as good as you all. And so, you know, we don't sail through life without bumps, but when we hit the bumps, we commit to riding through them and smoothing them out and getting back together.
Hey, John, that actually raises an interesting question. What lessons do you think that you have learned from peace activism that you're able to bring into your marriage life and vice versa? What lessons from being married have you learned that you're able to bring into the work of being a peace activist?
Yeah, I really think the answer to that is patience. You know, the willingness to stay at the table, the willingness to keep working on difficult issues, you know, and the understanding that you're not going to get it exactly right, that it's not going to be perfect, that the pendulum is going to swing a little bit this way and then it's going to swing a little bit back the other way. But if you keep showing up, if you keep doing the work, eventually, hopefully, pendulum's not going to swing so far in either direction. You know, if that center of the pendulum is balanced, that's the goal. And we don't really stay at balance for long periods of time. We usually sort of, you know, hit it and then we swing past it and then we realize we got to correct course and come back the other way a little bit. And I think that's, for me, that's the lesson that I've learned, is that willingness to keep at it, keep coming back and keep doing the hard work to find that balance.
Now that makes a lot of sense, and I can definitely see that balance would be a key. I was having the pleasure, I think it was last week, it might have been a couple of weeks ago, of talking to a contestant who unfortunately did not win, but they were running for Miss North Carolina, and then if they had won, they would have gone on to Miss America. And, you know, any of those beauty pageants, the number one thing that everybody that's in those contests say that they want is world peace. And definitely you hear that even among our athletes and even among our politicians. It seems that it's the number one thing that everybody wants. It also seems that it's the hardest thing for us to have in this world and everything. So as a peace activist, do you think that it's even achievable for us to have world peace, or is there always going to be some sort of conflict that's going on and we'll never have this utopian world that doesn't have some sort of conflict in it? Because, I mean, like I said, whether it's the people that are running for Miss America or it's the athlete that is giving his accolades after he's done some amazing thing, and they ask him, you know, what is he looking forward to having happen in the world and that he would like to see happen in the world. There's usually, you know, some prayers given to whoever the higher power is, and sometimes they might mention, you know, that they'd like to see a better world and all of that. So we hear these accolades all the time, and of course the politicians always bring it up, but is it even attainable?
Look, I'd love to believe we could find a utopia here on Earth, but I'm also a realist, and the human condition tells me that there's always going to be conflict of some sort. The question in my mind is how do we reduce it? You know, how do we lessen our inclination to use force to resolve what could be resolved in diplomatic situations? How do we find ways not to scapegoat and vilify entire, populations of our society? How do we find ways to remove systemic barriers to success? How do we find ways to reduce, disparity in outcomes for health or education or income inequities or any of these things? Are we going to get it perfect ever? No, I don't think so. Can we do better? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it says in our Constitution that we'll work towards a more perfect union, not the perfect union. And I think we can be more perfect than we are now. But it's going to take work. It's going to take determination. It's going to take some political will. It's the same thing that's changed things in our country historically. And the work's not done. You know, some of the things feel even bigger than they were before, but I don't know, because I wasn't around in the 50s. I wasn't around in the 1800s. But are they going to be hard? Yeah. But can we find ways to do it? I suspect we can. But it has to keep an eye on the common good. It has to keep an eye on, giving people the resources that they need in order to thrive.
No, I can definitely understand that. Now, one of the other things that sometimes happens in society is there are various institutions, whether it's the church institutions or the education, like the school institutions, and all of that. And I sometimes feel that they play a role in those divides that you're talking about, because, you know, a lot of times they will, and we talked about this earlier, vilify a certain segment of the population, and therefore those people will never make it, one, into heaven's gate, or two, they shouldn't even be around society, according to what people that are in those institutions may believe and all of that. And I'm thinking about, like, even if we look at, say, the LGBT community, and the trans community is part of that, or we look at some of the Hispanic community and some of the Asian communities as well, where there might be folks that are saying, you know, that they are going against the will of whatever that higher power is and all of that, and they use it as a vilification tool and all of that. So I was just wondering your thoughts about how institutions sometimes play a role in the disconnect of us getting to that utopia also, because I do sometimes feel that while I think we need to have a spiritual background and a spiritual connect to something that is beyond us, that sometimes the leaders within those institutions use their power as a way to vilify certain groups and organizations. And, you know, my whole attitude is what you do in your house and in your bedroom is your business, and I'm not going to make a judgment about it. And if anybody's going to make a judgment, it should be those higher powers from above, if you believe that such things exist.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, humanity enters into the picture. And so if the faith institution, whatever faith you're talking about, is good and whole and pure, you still might have some people who mess it up. And so historically, when I look back at Christianity, when I look at, the civil rights movement, I think you had churches, certain churches who were arguing that it was God's plan to keep white and black people separate, that it was, God's plan that white people were superior. And but you also had churches who were on the forefront with Dr. King, who were marching for justice, who were marching for equality. So in that regard, it's hard for me to say that it was the institution's failure. You know, it was individual churches' failure. It was individual leaders' failure to come out in that other way. But You know, I think the same with the LGBTQ community today. There are a lot of ways historically that the church has marginalized gender identity issues, but there are also churches who are, you know, warmly embracing all people and saying, you know, love is love, and that also is guided by their faith. So, you know, it's hard for me to cross off the entire institution of faith, because I'm a faith-based person, and I see ways that it has been used poorly and used well throughout history. And I would prefer to be part of the movement to shift those faith-based traditions towards using that faith well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I can definitely agree with you on that. Now, Dean is up there in the New Jersey, New York area. He's also in the correction system and all of that, in the sense of where he works and all of that. I was just wondering if you had, not because I know you're in the L.A. area, and of course you came from Minnesota, so you went from Midwest to West, but this is your second time of doing this kind of trip. I was just wondering if there were any stories that you found that were unique out of the New York, New Jersey area, or even out of the correction systems, that you would like to share with our audience as well, because I'm sure that you've got some fascinating stories of both of those kind of groups of people and everything. So, you know, definitely we mentioned Charleston, which is just down the road from me here in North Carolina, but I'd love to hear maybe some of your New York, New Jersey stories, as well as stories of things going on in the correction system that you've had the pleasure of talking to in the spaces of your interviews.
Yeah, you know, I was this is up in Philly. I was able to meet with Tyrone Wirtz, who had served 36 years of a life sentence for second-degree murder. His sentence was commuted, which means they didn't say he didn't do it, but they said he had served his time, that he had reformed his person, and he was let out. And so I interviewed him about a year after that. And, it was this really powerful conversation about him. He said when he went into prison, he was an angry young man, and he was arrogant. He was frustrated with the system. He said it took him a while to find a way to turn his life around, to let some of that anger go and to take classes. He got his degrees and became a mentor in literacy for other people in the prison. And he said it took him a while to turn into the man that his mother and father had raised him to be. You know, and he said that he wanted to make sure that his siblings and his daughter knew that even though he was in prison, that he was still a good person. You know, so again, I think there's this temptation to hear a label and to know one thing about a person and let that wash over their entire being. And I think it's really important that we take time to see the fuller human being. You know, Tyrone is not defined by, the worst act he was ever a part of. You know, there are other things that define him as well. And so that was really powerful. Went down to Texas to interview a man who was on death row, and then also interviewed a woman who had served in the warden's in the prison system, and she had witnessed as a public information officer, she had witnessed I think something like 300 executions over her time, and just what that does to a person's experience when you witness that sort of process, when you see the family dynamics around it, when you understand the human cost of that sort of judicial system. So yeah, we're in LA, possibly. We'll also connect with some organizations that are helping people involved in gang activity choose a new path, tattoo removal and job skills and these sorts of things to find a new path forward. And tomorrow I'll be interviewing a man who had lived on the streets and in LA here, and then wound up, going through a program with Union Rescue Mission, and now is employed by the organization that helps him find a path off the streets. So whatever the person's path, there are stories of hope. There are ways forward, and there are people who are willing to help. And so those are some of the things that we try to explore.
Speaking of stories of hope, I know that right here in Durham, I sometimes will run across people that are in that homeless population and that are definitely part of that homeless population. And sometimes you'll hear stories of them having been, you know, past professors or past doctors or past this or that, of kind of like what you were talking about, that million-dollar dream of yours. And apparently they had that, but then they, you know, for whatever reasons, their path caused them to become homeless and to not be able to maintain that middle class life, or in some cases even that rich life. But I do sometimes wonder how much of that story is actual fact and how much of that is embellishment, because we do know that there is also a lot of mental health issues within the homeless population as well. So I was just wondering, have you heard similar kind of stories, and how do you even verify those stories? Because I remember definitely there was one gentleman that I remember not that long ago meeting, maybe like about 5 or 6 years ago, and the rumor was that he had been a professor there at the university not that long ago and everything, but he had fell into hard times. But I never heard anybody that was able to verify that one way or the other. Not saying that other journalists and other people might not have found the verification, but I just didn't find it for whatever reason. But I was just wondering, how do you deal with these kind of situations, particularly in that population where there is some things that are going on, because we do know that there is mental health issues in the homeless population, not saying uniformly, but there are some that have those issues, and you just have some people that just naturally like to embellish things.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I listen a lot to a program called the Moth Story Hour, where people get up live and tell stories. They're usually like, you know, 5 or 10 minutes long. And the tagline of the Moth Story Hour is that these stories are true according to the people who tell them. You know, and I think we all have a mixed perception of who we are, right? If you asked somebody to tell my story, they might tell it differently than I'm going to tell my story. But I tend to trust people. I don't think I've been in situations where people have been bluffing me. I think people tend to bring their better angels to these conversations. And so I will challenge people if they say things that don't sound right to me, if they start, you know, talking about theories that I don't really disagree or that I don't really agree with, I'll press people on it. But at the end of the day, I'm there to listen. And for the most part, people respect that process and people come in and, you know, share stories fairly. You know, I did share one story of a guy, and I won't give you the details of it, but when I posted his interview online, you know, he claimed to have been a veteran, and it was something that he was really proud of. And when I posted the story, somebody else responded with a comment and they said, oh yeah, well, he was dishonorably discharged. He's a, you know, he's a loser. And I thought to myself, does it matter to me if this person was honorably discharged from the military or dishonorably discharged? Does that mean that the rest of the story that he's telling is valid or not? Does it mean I should question his integrity? And I came to the conclusion that it didn't matter to me how he left the military or under what conditions. He was talking about it, you know, different things in his interview around race and different things in his interview around justice, which had just as much validity whether he was a veteran or not. And so, you know, that sort of character assassination, I think, is really common today, where somebody says something and they go, oh yeah, but did you know this about him? Just trying to, you know, discredit their character. I mean, we saw that in Minneapolis, where I live, around George Floyd. Oh, well, he used drugs. Oh, well, he abused his wife. Well, does any of that mean that he deserved to die at the hands of a police officer? You know, I think there are ways that people try to discredit things, to change the narrative, to distract from the question at hand. But I think we have to stay focused on what the end goal is. So that was a really long question to your or answer to your question. But I have not really encountered where people have been, where I feel like people have been dishonest with me.
Definitely. You know, as always, John, when you're talking, I'm thinking of different questions and different thoughts and all of that. And one thing that I was just wondering, as you've been going around and even within the peace activism, and we kind of touched on it last time, do you sometimes find that people might have this attitude that you can't have two beliefs that seem like they might be opposed to each other, but they can't actually work together. And I'm maybe just going to use the example of Black Lives Matter, because you do have people that will say that, you know, definitely Black Lives Matter, but then they'll counter it by saying that folks that are, like, even in the field that Dean's involved in, corrections need to be balanced and need to be counted as well. So you'll hear that concept of, yes, Black Lives Matter, but so do Blue Lives, meaning the people that are in law enforcement. So I was just wondering, and we can even say that about different ethnic groups. So they'll say that, yes, Black Lives Matter, but that doesn't mean that we need to discount what the Asian Americans are going through or what the Latin Americans are going through as well. So I just wonder, when you hear people that try to kind of push one group against the other group, even though they're both probably working for a common goal, how do you deal with that even in the peace activism community?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I had this experience when I was talking about a piece of my mind to some group, and at the end, the guy who clearly saw the world differently than me, he said, "So I guess what I hear you saying is that all lives matter." You know, he was pressing back on the notion of Black Lives Matter. And I said to him, well, yeah, of course all lives matter. I said, but I'm also not afraid to say Black Lives Matter, and talked about it for a little bit. And he said, so all lives matter? I go, look, think of it this way. I said, if somebody is out there and they're saying save the whales, that doesn't mean, you know, screw the dolphins. Right. It doesn't mean kill the dolphins or forget about the dolphins. If somebody is out there wearing, you know, a pink ribbon for breast cancer, and I walk up to them and I say, hey, what about bladder cancer? You know, you need to be talking about that, too. You know, that's disrespectful. What that pink ribbon is saying is that we need some attention. There's an issue here. There's a crisis here, and we need some attention so that we can address it. It's not discounting everything else that's in the world. And so the same thing with Black Lives Matter. When somebody says Black Lives Matter, in my mind, it's not dismissing that all of the other lives matter. It's saying, look, historically, we've got some issues here that we need to deal with. There's been a long period of time where, you know, statistics and institutions and structures would tell you that Black lives haven't mattered, where this is calling attention to those issues. And so I'm happy to say Black Lives Matter. And when I hear pushback on it, you know, I respond, because I think it's not an either or sort of proposition. Black Lives Matter doesn't say forget about all of these other issues. It's saying, look, here's a call to action. And there are plenty of other calls of action that we can do too, but that's one that's at the forefront at the moment.
No, I definitely agree with you on that and everything, and definitely think that there can be solutions, including some solutions that folks may be surprised that folks even would agree on. I know that definitely here in North Carolina, in Asheville, the whole concept of reparations has come up, and I've even had conversations with friends of mine, and some of them are of the opinion that, you know, they don't need to have reparations because it wasn't their generation that was involved within slavery and things of that nature. So as a middle-aged white person, what are some of your thoughts about this whole reparation conversation that has been going around the nation as well? As a matter of fact, I was reading, and before you came on the conversation, I was going to bring it up to Dean, that Durham is actually looking at some reparations policies similar to Asheville, but they're actually doing policies that would be tied into it, including possibly giving some benefits to some folks that are in the minority communities and things along that line. But I just wonder what some of your thoughts are in that regard, and whether you think that that's something that we should even be considering in the whole concept of civil rights and peace activism.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't know what the final answer is for reparations, but I certainly think we ought to be having the conversation, you know, and of course, as you have the conversation, you're going to have a whole bunch of different perspectives on what it looks like. But reparations can look like cash money. Reparations can look like land. Reparations can look like job training. It can look like low cost loans. It can look like, you know, job training. I think all of these things are possibilities, and I think we're just now to the point where we seem to be getting a little bit of traction with conversations about reparations. You know, what was the community in Illinois that had identified housing discrimination redlining, what have you, you know, back in the day, who's decided that they're going to have some, you know, I think it's low-cost housing loans available for some people to try to correct some of that historic injustice. I don't know exactly what that should look like. I don't have the final answer, but I think that I'm encouraged that folks are starting to have the conversations. Now, I think what we'll probably find is that local communities are going to have more traction and make more progress in it before we get any kind of national solution. But I think that's okay, because I think those can be incubators for ideas. Those can be, you know, models of success again. And we can look at what seems to be just and what's not quite working right. And we can use those to sort of model some sort of larger response. Again, like everything, you know, it's a couple of days late and it's a process that's too slow. But what's encouraging is that it seems to be gaining momentum and we seem to be having the conversation, certainly more than I saw even just 5 years ago.
No, I definitely agree that we're seeing more of these conversations and more people are looking into different solutions and all of that. As a matter of fact, the reference that I was referring to Durham apparently just happened recently, and that's the city bus budget for the next fiscal year includes like $6 million that will go toward green and equitable infrastructures in historically African-American neighborhoods. So they're tending to allocate money every year going forward. And our current mayor, Steve Shule, says that he wants to see these efforts at a city level replicated on a national level. So he's hoping that this will be kind of a plan that folks can look at even on that national level. And definitely, like I mentioned before, Asheville was one of those cities. So it's definitely a way that you can possibly bring it about. And some folks may look at that as being too far, going too far to the left or not going too far to the progressive side. But like you, I believe that we've got to look at all kinds of ideas and put all kinds of ideas on the table and see which ones actually are legitimate and able to be dealt with and all of that. But that's just some of the things that I had seen that was going on in our recent fiscal situation and all of, along those lines. Hey, Gene, what are your thoughts? I've been letting you go. You know, I always have the conversation, but I'd love to get your voice as well. So I'd love to hear some of your thoughts about this great project that John is involved in of traveling around the world and definitely getting these great stories and all. But I'd love to hear your thoughts about what's going on. And I've actually got to have one of those quick breaks. So if you'll gather a little bit of conversation with them, I will do that. And I'll be back in about 2 minutes.
No problem. You know, it's got to be interesting to go to different places and see different things and take those pictures of so many different people from all walks of life and situations, circumstances, and even having conversations with people to see where they come from, what they've been through. You know, it's got to be very – it looked like it'll be kind of fun.
Well, most times it's fun. Sometimes it feels like work, but always it feels like purpose.
Right. Because you never know what a person has been through or what they're going through or if how they've made it through something if you don't have a – even if it's a short conversation with them. You know, a lot of
times
–
Well, you know what? And what I try to do is just open a space where people can share what's on their hearts. You know, I don't want to sit down with a black person and say, hey, what's it like being a black person? I don't want to sit down
right.
with someone in a wheelchair and say, hey, what's it like being in a wheelchair? You know, I want a fuller human conversation, you know, so I
right.
never know exactly where these conversations are going to go when we start it. So just a couple of weeks ago, I sat down with a woman, and I thought we were going to be talking about, you know, life in a small town and you know, water resources and things like that. But because we created a space where she felt heard and where she felt, you know, like she could talk from the heart, you know, she started talking about, you know, sexual assault, and she started talking about, you know, having been raped, you know, early in her life, and how that has continued to ripple out in her experiences and her relationships. And these sorts of conversations, I think, only happen when you create the space where people are feeling heard. You know, so I don't necessarily go into these conversations with an agenda. Yeah, I might want to talk about homelessness in L.A., or I might want to talk about, you know, indigenous rights in Louisiana. But what I really want to do is come to the table and hear what's on people's hearts. And so as we sit there and as the conversation unfolds over the course of an hour, it goes some really surprising and powerful places that I couldn't script if I had to. You know, I couldn't steer them there. They only go there because that's what the person wants to share, and they feel empowered to do that.
I'm back at everything. As I was hearing you, John, one of the things that I've been finding really interesting and fascinating is the amount of people that are really willing to be, for lack of a better term, exposed and definitely let their hurt, their harm, shape the narrative of what's going on. I've become good friends with a young lady named Nancy Burrows out of California. She's part of this LinkedIn influencer, Brian Schulman's crew, and all of that. But she definitely was, you know, went through some abuse as a youngster, and she's very open about it, and she talks about it, and she actually encourages others to bring it up as well. So I've been very astonished by the amount of folks that have used their hurt and their past and are being very vulnerable. Are you finding that, and I don't know whether it's the, you know, going back in time, the Dr. Phil and Donahue kind of syndrome and everything, but are you finding that we are becoming a more vulnerable society in the sense that we're really willing to expose a lot of our past hurts and pains in the hopes that we can help others get through whatever they're going through? Because she's just one example. I've also seen some people that are, you know, in the disability community that have been very forthright about what they've gone through and things of that nature. But I was just wondering, are you finding us to be a more forthright kind of society now?
Yeah, you know, I think that we are learning collectively that we do ourselves no favor to stuff this harm and trauma down and to put it away. Now, having said that, I also acknowledge that it's not everybody's idea of a good time to share their pain publicly, and we certainly don't ask anybody to do that. We follow their lead, and if they, you know, not everybody is going to want to share that. But for the people who do, three things typically happen. One is at a certain point in the conversation, either the subject or myself winds up in tears, usually both, because I think it's a powerful thing when you feel heard. Also, what I hear from people when they share this sort of thing is that it's cathartic for them. It's a part of their healing process to say it out loud, to acknowledge it, and to share it with people. And then the third is what you talked about, which is, you know, the hope is that that's going to help somebody else. So often, as people have shared stories about being through the prison system or, you know, suffering from substance abuse or, you know, making the journey across the border or whatever the thing is that's been difficult in their life, so often people have said to me, but if it can help one person, if it can make a difference for one person, if it can let them know that they're not alone, then it's all worth it. And I really think that there's a movement towards understanding that sense of collective liberation, that if we've been through garbage in our lives, that if there's some way we can help other people either navigate around that garbage or move through it a little bit more easily, then we've all sort of won together.
No, I definitely can agree with you, that kind of common goal and common unity and everything. And by the way, she's actually in the area that you're in, so I need to put you in touch with Ms. Burrows. Like I said, she's becoming a LinkedIn Live person herself and has a show called Community Connections, if I remember the title correctly. But she is there in Los Angeles and is a speech pathologist and is definitely in that space of using trauma to heal not just herself but others as well. So if you haven't reached out to me on LinkedIn or email, do that, and I will make that connection so that since you're there, y'all can know each other. And the same with Fernando Zeladon, who's actually been on our show here a couple of times, who is a activist in L.A. or in that general area in the Hispanic community and all of that. So just wanted to let you know that both of those are become friends of mine and are oftentimes following what I'm doing and I follow what they're doing, but they are there in that area working in two different spaces, one in the kind of migrant space in the sense of Fernando and one in more of the trauma space in the sense of Miss Barrows.
Yeah, yeah, I would love those connections, and I'll tell you, this is how this project grows. You know, you do one interview, and then the person says, oh, you ought to meet this person, and then that person says, oh, I got to introduce you to that person. And there's, you know, everybody has a story, and I've never gone into an interview and not come out of it feeling like I'm enriched by the process.
No, I can definitely see that in everything. What have been some of the stories that you found? I know we talked about the Latin American community, but you did mention the indigenous, which is kind of the Native American population, whether it's back home in Minnesota or whether it's out in the West. What are some of the stories that you have found that have fascinated you in that community? I know that I've got a cousin that's very active in that community. She's actually a participant along with her kids and her husband in the powwow circuit, which, you know, travels all over the country and all of that. But I was just wondering, what are some of the stories that you have found from our Native population?
Yeah, you know, I interviewed a man named Myron Poirier in North Dakota. He was Lakota, and he was working to change the name of Harney Peak, which, I'm sorry, he was in South Dakota. He was working to change the name of Harney Peak to Black Elk Peak. You know, if you look at the history of Harney Peak was the highest mountain in the state. The Harney, who it was named after, if you look at the history, there were some really unpleasant engagements with indigenous communities. There were, you know, there were reports of massacres and things like that. They wanted, you know, to rename that peak, and actually they were successful. So Harney Peak is now named Black Elk Peak, and that's a really small step in the right direction. That's a really small acknowledgement of some of the history that has happened. You know, when I was there, I was in the area of Wounded Knee. And when I visited Wounded Knee a couple of times, and the first time I was at Wounded Knee, I saw a sign, sort of a government-issued sign that said battle at Wounded Knee, but somebody from the local population had screwed a 2x4 over the word battle, and they had written in red paint, massacre at Wounded Knee, which I think probably more accurately reflects what happened at that historical site. When I went back about 5 years ago, the government issued sign that was there now reads massacre at Wounded Knee. You know, so these are really small movements, but they're at least symbolic movements in the right direction. You know, we were in South Louisiana talking about land loss, erosion down in the bayou, and we were talking you know, with the Dulac tribe and the Houma tribe communities about the resilience that they need as literally the land under their communities is eroding and washing away with climate change, with larger storms that are coming into the bayou. We were up in northern Minnesota with the Water Protectors, you know, an indigenous women's led movement to protect clean water resources and treaty rights up in northern Minnesota. And so, you know, just the ability to go up to the encampment and to spend a week with people and to interview people and also just sit sort of in community and get people a little bit, I think helps open up your mind, helps reveal where perhaps some of your blind spots are. You know, and for me, early on in the project, I didn't have many indigenous voices in my series. And so when I was talking about it at one point, somebody looked at the collection and they said that to me. They pointed it out to me, and I realized that they were right, and I needed to be more intentional about inviting indigenous voices into the project so that they could be seen and heard, you know, in the larger body of work along with everybody else. And so that the project continues to grow and evolve as I sort of see where the blind spots are, see where there are voices that haven't been represented. And then we can try to, include those and work them into the project as well.
And sometimes the small victories mean a lot. I mean, I'm thinking that even here in the South, we're seeing a lot of small victories where entire buildings are changing their names because they found out that some of the past people that they might have been named after had some very nasty history in terms of their racism and things of that nature. So I know that you had definitely done some research even in South Carolina and I guess in North Carolina as well around the Confederate monuments, but definitely we've also seen like even entire changing of academic buildings because somebody may have had a more racist past than they had originally been painted as. So I just wondered some of your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, you know, it gets really interesting because I was I interviewed down in Selma. I interviewed a woman named Joanne Bland who marched with Dr. King from Selma to Montgomery in the March for Voter Rights. So she was there for Bloody Sunday. She was there when they finally did the march, and they marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge from Brown Chapel across the Edmund Pettus Bridge and then on to Montgomery. And recently there's been some movement. You know, Edmund Pettus has some history around racism. And so some people wanted to change the name of that bridge to the John Lewis Bridge. But then when I talked to Joanne Bland about it, she's like, no, I don't want that. She said, I didn't march across the across the John Lewis Bridge. I marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and I'm afraid that we'll forget about that if we change the name. And so it, you know, it gets complicated, and you're going to find people with different opinions. Now, that being said, when I was down in Mississippi, I was in two different communities. I was in Oxford, which has two Confederate monuments, two big Confederate monuments, and then I was in Columbus, which had one large Confederate monument. The in Oxford, they've moved the one from the center of campus over to a Confederate cemetery away from the center of campus. The one that's in front of the county courthouse is still standing. Some activists are still working to move that. In Columbus, they moved the monument just recently from in front of the courthouse to the cemetery where there are some Confederate soldiers buried. So what's interesting to me is in both of those cases, even the activists who were working to relocate it, they weren't trying to destroy it. They weren't trying to tear it down. They weren't trying to quote unquote forget history. They were trying to move it away from the center of the community. They were trying to put it in a less prominent place and contextualize it. So it's interesting to me as you look at the different solutions. There are different ways to address it. Of course, there are different opinions about how it should be dealt with. I think personally, I think having them located at the county courthouse, which is the center, the perceived center of justice in a community, they simply don't belong there. These statues that talk about historical injustice don't belong sitting out in front of the building that is theoretically dedicated to justice.
Now, I can definitely agree with that. There just seems to be some places that certain things don't belong and all of that. And I remember there was something similar with the monument here in Durham. And I was trying to remember whether it was a civil rights monument or whether it was a just monument to our veterans. But I know one of the things that they did was they actually added the names. I think it was the Veterans Monument, but they actually added the names of the African-American veterans. Because I want to say that in the past they had been like in the back part of the monument, so they weren't visible. But now they've done some equitable things in order to make it like a more equitable treatment of all of those folks that were involved in that particular battle, be they African-American or European-American or whatever their ethnicity was. So they definitely tried to change some of the nature of how the monument was reflected in that regard. And I think that happened just maybe earlier this year and everything, or within the last several years. So definitely that was the way that they changed kind of the history of the, and it was actually, now that I'm looking at it, it was the Confederate monument there, but they've now added the, they've replaced it, and part of what they replaced it with was making sure that they had the names of everybody involved in all of that. So definitely it seems to me that there was a similar situation here as well, where they were trying to have some of the true history of what was going on.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we did a thing that we do very often as we travel. Besides these long-form interviews, we do these short little pop-up studios. And so right at the base of that Confederate monument in Oxford, we set up a studio, and we just asked people, what does this statue mean to you? And we took a black-and-white portrait. We asked people to respond in 25 words or less. And over the course of a couple of days, we had almost 40 people that participated. And they shared really interesting thoughts in really interesting ways. As it turns out, everybody but one wanted to see the monument moved. You know, we had very few people who showed up and said in defense of the statue. But 30 some of the people said that they wanted the monument moved. And so we do this as a way to sort of, you know, let the community talk, to get people to have conversations. We wound up in a local park putting up a large inflatable screen and then projecting this series for the community to see. And it's, again, coming from the north into Mississippi to talk about Confederate monuments, you know, one thing people don't like a lot is outside people coming in and telling them what to do. And that wasn't my goal, to tell people what to do. But I didn't really know how I was going to be received. And so I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, at the number of progressive voices in the community who came out to say, you know, this thing has to go. We got to take it down. I was also surprised that the same all-white county board who didn't want to move the statue, that they did agree to put another memorial on the grounds that commemorated the seven people in the county that the Equal Justice Initiative had identified as being lynched in the county historically. I would have expected that all-white county board who didn't want to take down the Confederate statue to say no to that sort of monument. So that leaves me room to believe that that some conversation can be had to sort of resolve this issue down the road.
No, I definitely agree with you on that. And just to, as I was looking up online and everything to give the correct perception, the monument that I was referring to was actually the World War One monument, but for years it had been only having listed the 40 white soldiers that had died during the war from this area and everything, but now they have added the other names as well. And apparently there was like some space things, and the way that the eight black soldiers who had passed were kind of like separated and all of that. So they have made it a more equitable kind of monument now, and this actually happened earlier this year, like within the last month or so. So I do remember that they actually took down the part of the Confederate monument, because that was one of our local protests and everything. So it's just good to see people actually doing things to make sure that folks are being properly commemorated and not being segregated even among the ways that folks might be honored and all of that. So it's good to see that people are trying to be more equitable in what they're doing and all of that. Could you just really quickly, and I know we're getting ready to wrap up, talk about, in your mind, the importance of oral history? Because I sometimes feel that we hear these stories, they're very important for us to share, and I think that we don't even do a good job sometimes of realizing that there are people in our own society that we should be talking to on a regular basis and learning their stories and their past. And too often these people, you know, they pass away and their stories are gone forever. I can think of even some historical figures here in Durham that I wish more people, including myself, had put down their oral histories and their stories. But now that they're gone, there's really no written or oral records of what they were about. So, I mean, part of what you do is that oral history, and including in addition to that written history, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about the importance of us actually writing down our history orally, or maintaining that historical arc of narrative.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just go back to that last thing you were saying about the monument there, and just add, you know, again, it took way too long for that to happen. It was way too slow for that historical correction to be in place, but it does give me hope that we're moving in that direction. So in my mind, one of two things is happening. Either there is a shift and a trend in society to look at that history with open eyes and to demand a little bit more equity, or this is just a short-lived blip, and then we'll all go back to, you know, the way it used to be. My sincere hope is that this is momentum. And if a piece of my mind, if the work that you're doing, if the work that so many of these people I'm encountering are doing can help nudge that momentum and keep it moving forward, you know, that's hopeful to me. But going on to your other question, the importance of oral histories, you know, I think for me, when, again, I talked about Studs Terkel earlier, who was an oral historian. He worked for the Chicago radio station and then the Chicago Historical Society. I read his book about the Depression called Hard Times when I was in college, and that was sort of my first introduction to him. And so Studs would talk to, you know, a milkman. He would talk to a stockbroker who lost everything in the Depression. He would talk to a prostitute. He would talk to a baseball player, all to understand how the Depression impacted their lives. And so the book was called Hard Times. And for me, as a student of history, when I would sit in a class and I would read dates and I would read historical highlights in a book, it all sort of made me go numb. You know, it was not that interesting to me. It didn't hold my attention. But when I found those oral histories of Studs Terkel, when I started hearing the human experience, when I started understanding what that meant for individual people, that brought it all to life to me. You know, that gave it shape and nuance and interest, and it drew me in, and it helped me understand that history in a new way. And so I think it's vitally important for us to document not just the headlines of the New York Times, not just the, you know, the major political winds that are blowing through our country and the world, but the day-to-day experience of ordinary human beings. You know, most of the people that I interview are not famous people. And I like it that way. You know, most of the people that I interview have not really been interviewed a bunch of times before. And I like it that way because there's a color to language and there's a way that they tell their story that always, always illuminates the world in new ways to me. And so I think when I do these interviews, I have three audiences in mind. And the first audience is myself, because in these conversations, I always wind up learning something new. I always wind up understanding the world in a new way. My second audience during the process is the person who I'm interviewing, because my hope is that they will come out of the experience feeling whole, feeling like they've been heard and seen and valued. And that sort of human interaction to me and human exchange to me is a really powerful experience for both of us. And then the third audience is the larger public. You know, because I'm pretty sure that if I can learn something from these conversations, the larger public can too. And so we gather the stories and we share them out. And then we also do public programming in schools and community centers and churches and universities across the country. And we use the stories to challenge our expectations, to challenge our bias, to open our eyes to our own blind spots, and to try to see the humanity of everyone who's around us.
Well, I definitely appreciate it. You've been a great interview, both this time as well as on the other show, the live streaming one earlier today, and I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. And sometimes to loop it around to what Dean has talked about with sports, sometimes it's the little small things that become historical footnotes and everything, because as you were talking, of course, I'm always getting news feeds and different other things, and I just recently learned that Trae Young may possibly not be playing tomorrow because he stepped on somebody's foot and apparently has a bone bruise. So apparently that referee will become possibly a historical footnote because he backed up on his foot, stepped on him, and now has a bone bruise. So if he doesn't play, will the Atlanta Hawks and all of those fans start blaming this referee whose name I don't even remember, but I remember that they had that brief incident yesterday that kind of swung the game and everything. So like I said, that could be an example of a small historical figure that plays a small sports highlight in the narrative of what's going on in the sports world, because literally he was backing up and just happened to bump into his foot and apparently received this bone bruise. So, like I said, he may not be playing in the fourth game because he decided to step on somebody's foot.
Life gets complicated fast, doesn't it?
It does. Dean, what's your thoughts about that, and definitely how even you might not even be intended to be a historical figure, because I don't think that referee was doing anything but trying to referee a game, but because he caused this injury, he may wind up becoming a historical footnote in the 2021 championships and all of that, or at least the run for the championship. But it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out, because sometimes it can just be a small little incident that happens that changes the arc of history, whether it's an arc of history in something that some people may consider trivial, like NBA basketball, or something complex like a world figure and all of that. So what are some of your thoughts about just the way that the arc of history can be changed by just one quick incident?
It can happen at any time, and you have to be able to accept it and deal with it, you know what I'm saying? So it anything can happen, and nothing is concrete. The only thing that is guaranteed is that one day we will all leave this place, and what matters is what you do while you're here to put something in a dash, because once the story of your life is over, it's up to what you have done that determines how it's read, you know? So, anything could happen, man.
The flap of the butterfly's wings, right? You don't know how it's going to impact the rest of the world.
Exactly. That flap of the butterfly's wings, you never know how it's going to impact anything whatsoever. But, John, I've thoroughly enjoyed having this conversation with you. Hope that you can come back on into the near future and share how these trips are going, share some of your tremendous stories that you are gathering. You know that you always have a welcome home here. I think this is your second time being with us, so you know you're always welcome to come back and share your stories, whether it's here or on our streaming platforms as well. But you definitely have a home here, and we're always glad to hear your stories. And of course, we'll have some more amazing guests. And if folks missed it, Dean will tell you all of the places that they can catch it at, because we're in the various replay locations. And of course, we've got some sister and brother programs as well that are part of our network, and I know that Dean will give the whole rundown of that, but I know we've got some more amazing guests from the world of entrepreneurship and creativity and activism and everything else that'll be coming their way in the next episode. So, Dean, we want to give folks a rundown of when we'll be back and what they can expect, because, you know, the 4th actually falls on a Sunday, so I'm guessing we're going to be back on the 5th, but it's your call once again.
Actually, you know what? It's still a holiday, man, so we'll be back actually in another 14 days. But so we'll be off next Monday, but the following Monday should be, what, the 12th, right? So
right. That's correct.
Looking at the calendar, yeah. So we'll be back once again on July the 12th, y'all. It is Straight Talk with Dean and Mark, Monday night, 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Don't forget to catch the replays tomorrow evening or afternoon and Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Skyhawk Radio Network. And if you missed those, then we do have other replays, and you can catch the replays on Radio Public, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Spreaker, TuneIn, Stitcher, Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, Podcast Addict, CastBox, PodFollow, Deezer, GeoSavin, and right here on Blog Talk Radio, where we also have the Level Podcast Network. You can catch shows like The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause, The Chef Gang Radio Show, Fun from the Front Seat, Funk Music with Zach, Learning Unwrapped, Let's K-12 Better, Marketing with Rush, a.k.a. hashtag Rush Selfie, Mona Shake and the Minority Reports, Mullings, Music and Memories with Mark Lee, The Online Dinner Party with Mark Lee, The Plant a Good Seed Podcast, The Reinvention Road Trip, She's on Call, The Just Podcast, The Mark Lee Show, The Spin It Social Hour, Virginia Interfaith Live, WNC Original Music, and Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. Like I always say, when you walk outside your front door, it's showtime and the world is your stage. Just make sure that people are not watching the rehearsal. With that being said, it's the six-man Dean Geronimo. Y'all stay cool. Keep the AC on. You know what I mean? Stay safe.
And drink plenty of sweet tea. Do all of that kind of stuff to stay cool.
Sweet
and everything.
Tea, lemonade, water, whatever you need to do, stay hydrated. Have an outstanding week. Have an outstanding week next week, and we see y'all in 14 days.
Indeed, if they need to see me before the 14 days and everything, I think the streaming shows will still be on the 5th. I'm still trying to make that call, but if they need to see me beyond that, on July 4th at the Festival at the Eno, I will be out there emceeing, and I believe I'll have the privilege of introducing none other than Shirley Caesar. So I'm looking forward to that. So that will be on that Sunday. So if they haven't heard enough of my voice and they for some reason need to hear more of it and also see my face, they can catch me at the Eno River State Park on Sunday the 4th, because I will be there on that Sunday doing the MC and announcing. So if they need to somehow see me or need to be in my presence, that's where they can find me at.
Well, you know what? Even before that, y'all, even before the 4th, y'all got to stop by Mark Lee's page and show him some love on Thursday. He's going to start off the month of July. It'll be his birthday. So make sure that y'all go by and show him some love. All right, y'all? Peace.
Peace.